Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A $1 trillion power play in Europe this weekend to beat back creditors howling at the gates of Greece and other debt-burdened countries of the EU. After a 1,000-point swoon in the Dow in minutes last week, Europe's shock and awe rescue brought markets back on Monday. Now come the questions. This hour on Point Global Markets, sovereign debt, and where things may go from here. You can join the conversation. What do you see in Europe's big bailout? Are you betting your 401k on it working? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke's commencement address to graduates of the University of South Carolina. We will go to Europe in a few minutes, and we will hear from economist Kenneth Rogoff. We begin in New York, looking at market volatility with Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Business Week. Robin, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
We're good. Tell us first, it's been several days now since that crazy 1,000-point drop in a matter of minutes on the Dow. What is the thinking at this point about what happened there, Robin, and whether or not it's something that could be prevented in the future?
Gosh, we still don't know, and that's so embarrassing. If I gave you a nickel for every conspiracy theory call I got over the weekend, you'd be quite a wealthy person. There was the fat finger theory. There was this idea that this was high frequency trading, that it was a self-fulfilling prophecy after one faulty order went in and triggered all sorts of program trading. We still don't know. And I think it's going to be a few days at the very least before something more credible comes out of this whole mess.
There was talk over the weekend from Senator Chris Dodd and others in Congress that maybe there should be intervention to stop something like that happening again. I guess if we don't know what made it happen, it's hard to know how to stop it. Or is there any idea that it could be prevented?
This is the pattern of regulatory response. It seems as though really time and again for the past 3 years, it's shown that Congress has had a failure of imagination. Washington has failed to kind of get its head around the size of the derivative situation on Wall Street. And, now it turns out that we have 1987 standard trading stop gaps there when, in fact, the world has since moved on. There are these high-frequency hedge funds that control whole swaths of the market. And regulators are very typically late to the game, and they're trying to understand this in a very frenzied fashion.
One of the theories is that computer trading played a huge role in what happened last week. What's the theory around that, Robin? How could these high-speed computer trades have ultimately led to such a rapid drop?
They almost have a mind like that HAL in 2001, a Kubrickian type scenario, where if, for example, one faulty trade comes in, a huge Dow component in Procter & Gamble, makes paper towels, shampoo, juice, suddenly the print on that trade is that the Procter & Gamble, for whatever reason, is down $20, or I don't remember what the actual number was, then it forces all sorts of program selling. Then the machine thinks, wow, something happened, therefore I must go out and then put these rapid-fire orders in to sell on the index. And even when you have the human touch and the New York Stock Exchange floor specialist there to kind of see that this is such an aberration, the way markets work these days is you have all these other ancillary exchanges that will take on that volume when the New York Stock Exchange slows things down and if the circuit breakers take hold. So the problem is, in this increasingly kind of fungible trading world, how do you control something that is decreasingly human?
Is it possible that we have a fundamentally broken market mechanism? And how does the unease over Europe's debt situation factor into that?
It was an unfortunate coincidence that, I was walking back from a Starbucks and I saw street scenes from Athens of rioting. And then suddenly the Dow was down 1,000 points and there were all sorts of conspiracy theories. Someone had thought that BP was going to be nationalized. I mean, in this vacuum of news, kind of it was theorize first, ask questions later. And that's the problem with this. When you can't take for granted the fact that your trading system is going to be robust and in place and there's going to be an orderly market, you know, all rhetoric aside, then you can't take anything for granted.
So huge questions about the trading system itself put on the table last week, and at the same time, mounting tension over what was going on in Europe. Then over the weekend, here comes Europe with a nearly $1 billion rescue plan to back up Greece and other very heavily debt-burdened European nations. Robin, stick with us for a second here. I want to listen to a little tape. This is from EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso. He went before cameras once this package was put together, the shock and awe package out of Europe, to say Europe would do whatever it takes to defend the euro from market speculators.
This morning's agreement will ensure that any attempt to weaken the stability of the euro will fail. We cannot have a monetary union without an economic union. This is the point.
This is the point, says the head of the EU. Robin Farzad, stand by in New York. With me in the studio now is economist Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University, co-author of the New York Times bestseller, This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Ken Rogoff, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
We called you a couple of weeks ago and looking at what was going on at Greece and said, this doesn't look good, let's talk. And you said, wait, it'll just get more interesting. Boy, were you right about that. Has the shock and awe package put a full stop to that or not?
Well, it's definitely kicked the can down the road, but I think the question's for how long. The big thing is that they didn't get the rot out of the system. I mean, Greece can't pay its debts. Portugal might not be able to pay its debts. Giving it a little bridge loan's not going to help.
A little bridge loan? $1 trillion? Well, I mean, that's not all for Greece or Portugal.
Giving it a couple of years bridge loan's mm-hmm. not going to help. And, you know, as far as the shock and awe, I mean, a lot of the money is not real. We have Italy, Ireland, Portugal, Greece. They're all kicking into this $1 trillion. Germany can barely pay its own debts. It's like California bailing out Arizona.
So they're kicking in when they themselves have these huge debt burdens that are the issue. The markets responded very favorably to this yesterday, Robin.
It did because, you know, the signaling in this is very important that maybe at least for now, Europe, for all its unwieldiness, kind of gets it, that it has to get ahead of this, you know, cabal of speculators, real or just perceived. And so that number, that headline number was big. And obviously coming off the relief of you know, what happened at the end of last week, that, you know, I agree with Professor Rogoff, this at least is a bridge loan, and it buys time for a situation that's increasingly looking untenable.
So, Ken Rogoff, what are the fundamentals beneath this bridge loan then? What's really going on here?
They were scared that if they let Greece default, if they let Portugal default, that all chaos would break loose. It would go to Spain, maybe to Italy. They didn't know where to draw the line. They were looking at Lehman, obviously. They were worried that if they let Greece go, maybe that would be the European Lehman. That's why
Lehman Brothers let go in the U.S. and everything came down behind it.
Right. But the problem is by not letting anybody go, there's no discipline in the system. When people bought the euro, they were told, you've got German debt. Everybody's become like Germany, which is really good repair.
In other words, first class, blue chip.
Absolutely. Terrific stuff. Now you're learning you're getting Greek debt, which is a country that's been in default half its years since independence.
So Greece and Spain and Portugal and more are being asked to, squeeze their budgets to adopt austerity programs to make this whole thing work out, to make the bridge period amount to something.
Well, huge austerity because they're all borrowing way beyond their means. So are we in the United States, but right now the Chinese and others lend us money. No one wants to lend them money. And now except the International Monetary Fund and their fellow Europeans. They have to go through incredible austerity. They have to have recession for years. At the end of it, they're going to have a huge debt. What are they going to do then?
Now, Robin, part of this was to warn away speculators and investors who were sort of betting on a big fall there. Looking at Daniel Dresner here in Foreign Policy, saying this $1 trillion is like Clint Eastwood out of Dirty Harry, you know, saying, do you feel lucky? Do you feel like you can bet against my $1 trillion bazooka, somebody called it? Well, do you, punk, he asks. Is this scaring back speculators who are looking at the euro in these markets and making plays on their fall?
It might for now, but we know how speculators work, that this suddenly, you know, if this makes this look kind of a radioactive opportunity for speculators, they'll be back. If they see an opportunity, if they see it kind of being half-hearted, if they start to look at the tail end of some of these terms, what these countries will end up looking like fiscally in 5 or 6 years, then certainly they can put pressure on the euro all over again. I think it still underscores, and it only sweeps under the rug for now, the sheer asymmetry of the European Monetary Union. And you have a central bank and ostensibly an independent, we thought, central banker for these eurozone economies, but you have absolutely uncentralized fiscal discipline, where Greece was free to go off on its own and, you know, sugarcoat its books for the longest time. You suddenly have these other these tier two, tier three economies that Wall Street wags are calling the pigs. You know, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, mm-hmm. Greece, and Spain. And so it's this tale of two or three Greeces already.
But $1 trillion, can Rogoff, looks serious. I mean, what else can they do? This has got to be the way you begin to address this, or not?
It is, but the Europeans, if they're thinking this is about speculators of what the problem is, they have their head in the sand. This isn't about speculators.
Swedish finance minister talked about wolf packs of
speculators. He wishes that was the problem. The problem's that there are just no buyers for these bonds. They are churning out debt like there's no tomorrow. It's their main export. You want to have the Asians buy it, the central banks buy it, you want to have pension funds buy it. Nobody's going to buy these debts except for speculators soon. The problems, they have to get their finances in order. This isn't about speculators. It's about profound fissures in the European Union.
But how do you grow out of this problem when you're asking for austerity? That doesn't sound like a recipe for, you know, fizzy, rapid growth.
No, I think what they really ought to have done is let Portugal and Greece go and then ring fence the rest.
Let them go, as in out of the EU.
Restructure their debt. I think it's in their interest.
They'd have to do it outside the EU.
Well, to the drachma. Probably it makes sense to drop out of the euro when they did that. And that would scare Spain and Italy and the other countries into tightening more, and maybe they could solve it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's shock and awe rescue play and whether it is enough to settle global worries over sovereign debt and markets that have been in some strange places in recent days. Robin Farzad joins us from Bloomberg Businessweek, joins us from New York, senior writer there. Economist Kenneth Rogoff joins us, co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. We're going in just a moment to Europe. Here's German Chancellor Angela Merkel yesterday in Berlin explaining to the German people that the rescue package was rescuing a heck of a lot more than just Greek pensioners.
It is unprecedented in the history of the euro and the European Union, and we are protecting our currency during extraordinary circumstances. To our citizens, let me put it this way, we're protecting the money of the German people.
We're protecting the money of the German people, though German people have expressed a lot of skepticism about that lately. We're joined right now from Brussels by Wolfgang Munchau. He's associate editor and European commentator at the Financial Times, founder, former editor-in-chief of the Financial Times Deutschland, president of Eurointelligence.com. Wolfgang Munchau, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Hello.
Are the German people buying Chancellor Merkel's explanation of what's going on?
No, they're not buying it at all. They were completely shocked by it. Chancellor Merkel had told them for months that there wouldn't be a bailout. She really played it very tough. And then within a week, she accepted the bailout to Greece, and then she accepted an even bigger package. And during that period, she never explained it. There was never any hint. So when Germany woke up on Monday morning, that was a complete, you know, they were really shocked and awed by this package, you can tell you that.
We've seen headlines from German newspapers, you know, the Greeks are stealing our money, all in bold.
Well, that's obviously, there has been a breakout of some xenophobia, but I think the basic mistake was that the situation was not explained, that it was seen as a, you know, us against them thing. It was done, it was, you know, amplified by German politics, by including the Chancellor herself. And, you know, when the situation got serious, when that position, you know, no longer worked, when financial markets tested the resolve of European politicians to actually do anything about it, then they had to deliver. They got scared. In the end, they gave in, and this is the situation we have now.
Just make it plain for us, then. What was the fear that brought everybody to the table for these midnight meetings over this weekend that finally brought Angela Merkel to sign off on a nearly trillion-dollar bailout? What was the fear? What was the gun to their head?
Well, she had come to Brussels on Friday with the intention only to sign the Greek bit of the bailout, which had been agreed before. Which
this is 100 and some smaller. Billion euros.
Exactly, 110 billion euros. Mm-hmm. And she also came into this meeting with a suggestion of a tougher rules. And then she, you know, the president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, and also the president of the European Central Bank and others impressed on her that the situation is significantly more serious than she appeared to think, and that the future of the Eurozone was at stake, that this was not just a matter of Greece, that Portugal and Spain are under attack, and that within days interest rates in those two countries could be so high that both of those countries would also need a bailout that would exceed the ability of the European Union to actually deliver. So they decided we have to act now, we actually have to, for once, get ahead of the expectations in financial markets and come up with this enormous package of, you know, three quarters of a billion, of a trillion euros, almost a trillion, you know, dollars, which is unprecedented.
Wolfgang, walk us through this. I've got a Facebook question here from Thomas Neil Garcia saying, I'm worried about the U.S. Fed, Federal Reserve, backing this up with dollars. Now, that's not at the center of this, but what are the main elements, and at what point does it actually touch American money?
I don't think it touches American money. There are what the Fed has done. The Fed has reopened swap lines, which they had opened during the crisis, as many European banks need to refinance themselves in dollars. They were short on dollars, and the global swap markets have dried out. So that was a help given by the United States.
That's liquidity from the Fed. Liquidity from the liquidity there from the Fed to Europeans if and when they need it.
Exactly. This is a liquidity support. I wouldn't expect this to be the main fallout of the package. There would be other problems occurring in Europe, but I suspect the U.S. money is going to be saved.
But the IMF is in here as well for a couple of hundred billion dollars or euros. I forget now. That includes money from lots of countries.
That's exactly. That's the IMF is there, but we should just remember this is a guarantee. This is not a program that is triggered at this moment.
Right.
At this moment, this is simply something that happens when the whole thing goes wrong. This is what happens when the whole of Europe were to collapse. This is a situation when, you know, you would be asking bigger questions, because it would be such a financial meltdown, that situation, that the question of how much it's going to cost us is probably the least of your worries at that point.
Ken Rogoff with me here in the studio. What do you see in the outlines of this rescue package? As Wolfgang Munchau says, it's not all executed. It's there waiting. It's like the buffer, I guess, or the backup.
Oh, yeah, but the big action is that the European Central Bank has gone in and started buying government debt, bank debt, junk debt across Europe, stuff
when nobody else would.
Just on Thursday, Trichet, the head of the European Central Bank, said they'd never do it. And, you know, it's a huge compromise of the European Central Bank's independence. Maybe they had to do it, but that's the real action. That's where markets have been calmed. In many ways, this $1 trillion, much of which may never materialize, mm-hmm. is a fig leaf to cover up for the ECB racing in to save the day.
Wolfgang Munchau, is it a fundamental change for the EU that the central bank is coming in to buy debt on this scale? Does that change the economic, maybe even the political nature of this union?
Absolutely, and if you talk to the central bankers, as I did, you actually sense a great tension that they have not had before. I mean, here they look. I mean, they had two U-turns. One was on the bonds that Kenneth just mentioned, but the other one was on Greek collateral, which they now have to accept, even though the Greek government bonds have been classified as junk status by one of the rating agencies. And it's basically a sense that political events are taking over here, and that the central bank is now forced into action that it doesn't want to take. That's the message they're giving out. And a lot of people here fear that this might lead to a weaker a weaker union. The German press this morning, you know, headlined that this would lead to inflation and instability, etc. So this has signals, and I very much agree with Ken that the main action here is the program to support the bond market by the ECB. This is the main element, the main support package.
Robin Farzad at Bloomberg Businessweek in New York. Now, on the first day, on Monday, we saw a very strong resurgence in markets after this was all announced. The follow-on has not been necessarily so positive. We've seen markets down. If the European Central Bank is in there buying debt and they've got a $1 trillion guarantee standing behind that further, why aren't the markets happy?
We have to see what the euro itself does. The euro has been unusually weak of late, and we have to see what the individual bond yields end up doing. You know, Greek debt, I think, was yielding above 24% or something right before this shock and awe measure was announced. It's a bit of a game of chicken where, you know, again, if the speculator community, real or perceived, you have to constantly keep your eye on the control panel as the central bank there. A central bank, which historically in Europe has been fiercely independent, you know, almost uniquely, uniformly focused on inflation, now has all these other mandates, has been forced to take junk collateral. All these taboos were just shattered, monetary taboos, in a matter of, you know, 48 hours. So there are a lot of moving parts here, and it's very much an open question if we see a stabilization in some of these, you know, these bond spreads, and investors can once again take for granted that Europe is not going to become unglued.
Franken Markets, one of our commenters, says online. Let's get a call. Our caller's in here, Craftsbury, Vermont. Angus. Angus, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
My point is that the money actually doesn't go to the people in the long run. I mean, it stabilizes a market which is unstable because of the ultra wealth in both America and in Europe, you know, flushing or trying to contain their, you know, wealth in real high places instead of it disseminating throughout the population.
So do you mean ultra wealth, or are we living beyond our means? Or you're saying, I see, concentrated wealth, trying to hang on to that concentrated wealth?
Right.
Ken Rogoff, what do you say to Angus?
Well, I think it's a good question. I want to pick up on Greece. I mean, it is not obvious it is in the interest of the Greek people to repay their debts, not to have a restructuring. I don't think they're going to make it. They're being asked to suffer through 3 years of recession, unemployment, cut wages, end up with more debt at the end, probably still end up defaulting, restructuring. This is certainly understandable why they're protesting.
In other words, you'd say maybe Greece should default, let the banks take the hit, but we're told that that's calamitous, that can...
It's probably in Greece's interest, and they're being pressured by Europe that that's a catastrophe because the contagion would spread. But if it's just up to Greece, I think that would be in their best interest to do it now.
Wolfgang Munchau in Brussels, is this all about protecting European and maybe American bankers?
Absolutely. I completely agree. The best course of action would be to allow for a negotiated default, a restructuring of the debt, maybe a rescheduling of the debt, a haircut, as they call it, a reduction in the value, a negotiated reduction of the value in the bonds by perhaps 30-40% would probably go a long way. Others are even going as far as 50% to make it possible for Greece to make the adjustment.
So why not do it? Why wasn't that the path taken over the weekend instead of shock and awe?
There were many reasons. One of the reasons was that the Europeans thought it would damage their banking system. I also heard that the U.S. administration would not have been happy about it and made representations that this action should not be pursued at this time. The IMF opposed it, so there was a lot of concern about the stability of the global financial sector, that any suggestion that Greece would restructure would immediately cause ripples that would spread beyond Europe into the United States.
Ken, what about U.S. pressure here over this weekend?
Well, there's no doubt the U.S. administration was in contact. We have to support them. I mean, I suspect whatever path they would have gone, we would have supported. But a Greek default was never really on the table. What they're trying to do is push it away a couple years to where the economy is stronger. They're hoping that, okay, Greece might still go, Portugal might still go, but when it hits, Spain will be stronger, Ireland will be stronger, Germany will be stronger. That's the plan.
So recovery as an antidote to contagion.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the
patient's
plan.
Too weak right now.
But the trouble is mm-hmm. the cancer may spread during that period if they don't cauterize the wound, so to speak. I'm not quite sure the right medical analogy here. I'm swimming. Mixing
metaphors
here.
And the street, the
Robin,
street
yes,
still
Robin?
Has a say. I'm sorry, the street still has a say in this. This by no means. I mean, you're asking, populations across Europe to take on austerity going out 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
Let's amortize this pain as opposed to taking it in one fell swoop. Let's not send the economy into outright depression or borderline depression by defaulting, by, risking the stigma, losing our prestige. Well, let's just spread that out. Now, that itself is going to come at high cost, especially with a lot of these left statist, center-left governments that cannot face down their public sector unions.
So you're saying the street has a say in, meaning they might still reject this two, three, four-year spread out of the pain?
Well, if these countries are on the hook, if the likes of Portugal and Spain are now on the hook, if the cost of this money, the true cost of this capital, this backstop, is going back and finding, fiscal religion, which I think the verdict is still out if they're ultimately going to do that, because historically it's proved much to be easier to go out and default than to have to stare down your unions. But if suddenly Washington and Brussels is trying to keep them honest, then that sets up a confrontation. I think a lot still remains to be seen on the street.
Let's go to Sterling, Massachusetts. And Al, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Something in this problem defies my simple logic. California, which is like the fifth or sixth biggest economy in the world, has been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy now for 2 or 3 years. And now we have this dinky little country, which is probably the 50th or 100th biggest economy in the world.
You're talking Greece.
About to go broke.
Yeah.
Greece. And it's like sending a world panic. I mean, it's like, who cares about Greece? Let them go broke. It's like Rhode Island going broke in the United States. What, is the United States going to cease to function because Rhode Island defaults or something?
Al, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Ken Rogoff, dinky little country, let them go, Al says.
We could see a couple small states default someday if we have another recession. It's happened in the past. The concerns, the contagion that Wolfgang mentioned, that's really the concern. They don't know where it'll stop. They were going to have to draw a line in the sand somewhere. The questions, why did they circle Greece inside it instead of outside
and
it?
Just spell it out, what the contagion means. What would spread? What's the problem?
Well, all these countries, they don't just have debt. They need to borrow more and more. They're not living within their means. They're constantly voracious appetite for debt.
Al says cut them off.
And if they see Greece defaulting, suddenly nobody's going to want to lend money to the periphery countries. I think that may be the case anyway. They'd have to pay really high interest rates. Then even if they were okay at normal interest rates, at the sky-high interest rates, they're not. A version of the subprime problem in Europe.
And economies freeze up across Europe, and that dominoes.
That's what they were scared of. They didn't know where it would stop. It hits German banks because they hold Spanish and Greek debt, and then U.S. banks hold crossed lines with German banks. They didn't know where it would stop. They were nervous about unintended consequences.
Wolfgang Munchau, what's the big picture here? Does the EU survive this? I mean, people are now talking about maybe the whole thing coming unbuckled.
Well, that is sort of an extreme scenario. I wouldn't go as far.
Mm-hmm.
And also to pick up on Ken's point of why didn't they just let Greece go? I mean, the EU is regulated by international treaty, by a law, and the law, just like the U.S. Constitution, it just doesn't allow states to go. We just don't allow, countries to go. There is no exit from the monetary union, as simple as that. Now, there may be forced extreme circumstances in which that would happen, in which they would have to change the constitutional law. It would have to be ratified by 27 states. It's a procedure that people understandably want to avoid. So the presumption is that every country in the European Union and in the monetary union in particular is going to stay there, and that any problems that arise would be sorted out in between. But economically, there is no question. There, the two options for Greece are either default, or devaluation. And since devaluation inside a monetary union is not possible, at least not nominal devaluation, that default is the alternative. I would expect that the minute Greece would be allowed to let go, there would be a speculative attack on Spain and Portugal of a significantly stronger proportion than anything we've seen in the past, as people would expect Spain, Portugal to leave, maybe even Italy to leave, which has a completely different problem, not one of, you know, indebtedness of the private sector, but, you know, a competitiveness problem.
Wolfgang Munchau with the Financial Times in Brussels. We've got to let you go right there, I know, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so very much. Ken Rogoff, Robin Farzad, please stand by. We're looking at global markets, sovereign debt, and Europe. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's shock and awe rescue play and whether it's enough to settle global worries over sovereign debt in Europe and, for that matter, beyond. Kenneth Rogoff joins us, professor of economics and public policy at Harvard University, co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. He's got the very big picture here. And Robin Farzad is with us from Bloomberg Businessweek in New York, a senior writer there watching everything in the markets these last days in the U.S. And globally. We've got a lot of calls and questions here. Eddie in Iowa City, Iowa. Eddie, you are on the air.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to respond to what your last caller said about why we should care about Greece right now.
Go for it.
I'd like to say that, indeed, they are a dinky country, but the reason is that there are some pretty deep economic reasons behind it. And the fact is that right now, Greece is very important to us economically, to the United States, over the next couple of days. When the U.S. government goes through a recession, or the U.S. economy, I should say, it affects the whole world and over a vast period of time, like 2 years or so. When Greece has a big collapse like this, it does affect us, but it does affect us for around 2 days or so-ish.
Two days. 2 days would be nice. 2 days would be manageable. But Eddie, thanks for your call. Ken, I mean, there's Iowa City pushing back and saying, come on, it may be dinky, but it matters, certainly right now.
Well, Europe matters. The overall European economy is bigger than the United States. There are major export destination by some measures. This is not going to be good for job growth in the United States. It's not going to be good for us coming out of a recession if they have a huge crisis across Europe. If they could contain it to Greece, I don't think it would have that big an effect.
But the fear is, because of debt levels in so many other countries there, we said Portugal, Spain, Ireland, maybe even Italy, it could sweep right on across there. Got more questions. Killingworth, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think I'm uncertain if there's any historical precedent, you know, that could really inform us in this situation. But I'm curious how you know, your panel sees this playing out 6 to 12 months from now, you know, in Greece, if there were to be a default. And I don't really mean from, you know, a social perspective. We saw how the unions were able to mobilize the protesters quickly and almost have chaos. But, like, what do you see happening financially, both in the institutions and for the average citizenry there?
Yeah, we'll do it, Steve. Thank you. Ken, give us, I mean, you've got 8 centuries of financial folly in your book, so we come to you for a historical perspective. Paul Krugman reads this situation, reads your book, and looks at Mexico in 1827 or something. What do you see?
You know, the good news about this is that every time we've had a wave of global banking crises like we had, within 2 or 3 years, like day follows night, you get these sovereign debt crises, as we're seeing in Europe, and we write about that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an aftershock. It usually is not the end of the world. The economy grows. It ends. It's part of the process. Why does it happen? Because governments borrow like crazy in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And the governments that are already borrowing like crazy, like Greece, they're even worse off. So, you know, to some extent, I think it's important to keep that perspective on things, that probably they will deal with it. It's not fun. If you're on top of the aftershock in Europe, it's especially not fun.
Are there precedents for the level of sovereign debt we see in the world today among major powers, I don't know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago?
Post-war, yes. So coming out of World War II, we saw debt levels in Britain, the United States, higher than what we have today. But that's a very different situation because all of a sudden you don't have the wartime spending. You save money on that. You have all these soldiers coming home to work. That helps the economy grow. We're not in that position. This is a debt that resulted from political paralysis, from the growing social state. So it's certainly problematic. I think the U.S. will have its own low-grade version of the Greek crisis someday.
Robin Farzad, I mean, markets have been very weird over recent days, and not only in Europe and the U.S. where debt is high, but look at China's down some 20-something percent since last November, concerns there as well. I mean, the difference between now and after World War II, I guess, is you've got big new players on the scene, but shouldn't that give us some global economic security, Robin, or is everybody vulnerable when you get this going?
Put this in the context of what we've just been through in the past 36 months. The entire global financial system melts down in the autumn of 2008. United States markets reach a 12-year low by March of 2009. I'm sorry, almost a 13, 14-year low, and in inflation-adjusted terms, a low that we haven't seen since LBJ was president. Banks failing left and right. Fannie and Freddie effectively nationalized. The entire system, all of these taboos are shattered in an instant. And the stock market manages to surge from that low, I think, 65 to 70%. There was a spectacular run last year, one, incidentally, that individual investors have been disproportionately underparticipated in. It's kind of like, so what? You know what? I'm not going there again. You're not going to fool me thrice.
Yep.
So I think that's muted, I think, the man on the street impact of what's going on in Greece.
Let's go to Tom in Springfield, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. What do you see?
Well, I'd just like to point out to, you know, it hasn't been discussed. It, to my mind, it seems like the political ideology is what's driving most of this. And the reason that the socialized systems aren't working is because of that. And you're not even addressing that part of it. All you're looking at is the, you know, the economics of it. But what got us all in that place was, in my mind, socialism. So would your guest please address that?
We'll do it, Tom. Ken Rogoff, over the weekend, you've had European leaders saying, look, our whole social welfare kind of system is on the line here, and we may have to have big cutbacks all over the place. Tom's looking at that and sees an indictment of the whole sort of euro system.
Well, there's no question they can't afford the social welfare state. They have just their demographics, their birth rates. They're at 1.4 per woman. That's not enough to replace
the aging
population.
Yeah.
Who's going to work? Who's going to pay all these pensions? They had a big problem already, bigger than ours. And certainly this is a wake-up call to that. The Greeks had a retirement age, it is said, of 53. The Germans are very angry about that. Why should we pay for that?
Greeks sitting on lovely beaches at age 53 when they're still working up in Frankfurt.
Exactly.
So
drinking ouzo.
Drinking ouzo. The rage, the outrage. So, but what does this mean, Ken? What is the big picture? It feels like we're in some kind of race. We've got this kind of monster. I mean, last week we saw a 1,000-point drop. Now, maybe that was some craziness of computers. But, you know, we all know there's a deep unease underneath the world economy right now. We've got this mountain of sovereign debt in many nations. What's the race here?
Well, I mean, I think Robin had the right perspective that you have to put this in perspective of where we are versus where we were. We just had something awful happen. This is a very characteristic aftershock. It's a reason to remember we're not galloping away. But I think it's also wrong to panic and say, oh, my gosh, the world's coming to an end. That said, the debt problems, the pension problems, the caller alluded to, the social promises, something's got to give over the next 5 to 10 years unless we have miraculous productivity growth thanks to globalization, the Chinese. I don't think that's realistic. I don't think that's going to save us. I think we're going to need to raise taxes, tighten our pension systems, tighten our belts. Public does not want to hear it.
So, Robin Farzad, you talked about the street and its vote. What's it expecting? For the public to tighten its belt? For, I don't know, for bankers to have a less juicy ride? What's the street looking for here?
It's very hard to engineer this. Obviously, when times are great, public coffers that overfloweth, as they did at the beginning of last decade, they hide a lot of your sins, a lot of your deficiencies. Municipal governments, state governments, they kind of punt on issues in confronting certain constituencies because it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. It's not my problem. It's for another administration. I'll be running for this other office by then. And writ large, writ times, you know, however many thousands of situations, and when you take it on a national level, such as Greece, these things all tend to come back to take the entire system hostage after a crisis of this magnitude that we saw 3 years ago. Professor Rogoff is dead on in saying that it's so predictable that, you know, the reverb, the aftershock of this thing, it's just the magnitude of it just seems so enormous because of, you know, the number attached to this type of intervention, the sheer unprecedented nature of it. But I think that with the benefit of a couple of years of you know, maybe stability, if people can finally take for granted that the system is not going to fall apart and there are going to be bumps along the way, that they might look back and say that this was a learning experience for Greece, if it has that much time.
Stability plus austerity. Here's a web question from Rob Ken Rogoff. He says, can someone explain why it makes sense, why it's beneficial, why it's necessary to have gamblers hold sway over whole economies?
It's a good question. We've got to do something with our regulation, with our financial system. It's absurd what's happened, and I'm worried. It's a whole topic for another conversation.
But is it the gamblers or the borrowers?
Well, it's all of us are gamblers at heart. The people who bought houses, the people who bought the subprime mortgages, the people who bought Greek debt. Hey, you were getting an extra couple percent or two on Greek debt. Did you think you had a free lunch? Did you really think it was German debt? At some level, we were all gambling, and the system needs to have a better way for the people who gambled to pay the price.
Is austerity on the menu for everybody here to get out of this, or is it growth in good times to get out of this?
I don't think we're going to grow our way out of this. Reinhardt and I find in our work that you seldom grow your way out of these deep debt crises. It's just the opposite. You grow slower. We will in the U.S., in Germany, we will have to tighten our belts. It's coming. It's going to be very, very traumatic politically.
Robin, have the markets taken that into account? You know, do we have a market that's presuming austere times?
It's a very bizarre market, especially if you look at bond yields, treasury yields in the United States. If we're debasing the dollar here in the United States, if we're, you know, we paid the long overdue tab for this decade of excess and subprime alchemy and everything else, and yes, the system, let's call it a mulligan and everything. Let's bail out this bank. Let's bail out this institution. Let's have an unlimited treasury backstop for Fannie and Freddie. Everything goes. Creditors will be protected. Mm-hmm. Well, you do have to pay for that at some point. But we're not seeing that in treasury yields. Why is it still so possible for the United States government to go out and borrow money in 10 years for less than 4%?
Well, this time is
different. There's a lot of people willing to think that it's different. And I wholeheartedly recommend you read that book.
We got to go. Robin Farzad with Bloomberg Businessweek in New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kenneth Rogoff, co-author of This Time is Different, 8 Centuries of Financial Folly. Ken, great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke tells college graduates to look at more than money to find happiness. This is On Point. In this college graduation season, we're going to be airing excerpts from a few commencement addresses. On Saturday, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke addressed graduates of the University of South Carolina in Columbia. His message was simple, echoing the wisdom of parents across the country that money doesn't buy happiness. Finding happiness, he said, is about more than just what you earn.
Notwithstanding that income contributes to well-being, the economics of happiness is also a useful antidote to the tendency of economists to focus exclusively on the material determinants of social welfare, such as GDP. GDP is not itself the final objective of policy, just as an increase in income should not be a good enough reason for you to change jobs. Obtaining broader measures of human welfare is challenging, but not impossible. Indeed, the United Nations has produced its human development reports for 20 years, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has been engaged in a comprehensive project to examine the progress of societies in order to ensure that economic policymaking focuses on improving human welfare more broadly construed. But even though GDP or income should not be the only goal of your strivings, we can go one step further and recognize as well that happiness itself, at least to the extent that that term is associated with immediate rather than longer lasting feelings and emotions, should not be our only goal either. Remember that I began by distinguishing between happiness and life satisfaction. Happiness is just one component of the broader, longer-term concept of life satisfaction, and only one indicator of how the fabric of our lives is shaped by our choices and circumstances. I'm reminded of a story about Abraham Lincoln. According to this story, Lincoln was riding with a friend in a carriage on a rainy evening. And as they rode, Lincoln told the friend that he believed in what economists would call utility-maximizing theories of behavior, which mean that people always act so as to maximize their own personal happiness and for no other reason. Now, just then, the carriage crossed a bridge, and Lincoln saw a pig stuck in the muddy riverbank. Telling the carriage driver to stop, Lincoln struggled through the rain and mud and picked up the pig and carried it to safety. When the muddy Lincoln returned to the carriage, his friend naturally pointed out that he had just disproved his own hypothesis by putting himself to great trouble and discomfort to save a pig. "Not at all," said Lincoln. "What I did is perfectly consistent with my theory. If I hadn't saved that pig, I would have felt terrible." The story points out that sometimes happiness is nature's way of telling us we're doing the right thing. True. But by the same token, ephemeral feelings of happiness are not always reliable indicators that we're on the right path. Ultimately, life satisfaction is something more than just happiness. Sometimes difficult choices can open the doors to future opportunities, and the short-run pain is worth the long-run gain. Just as importantly, life satisfaction requires an ethical framework. Everyone requires such a framework for satisfaction. In the short run, it is possible that doing the ethical thing will make you feel, well, unhappy. But in the long run, it's essential for a satisfying and well-balanced life. Thank you for this opportunity to address you. This is an exciting day for the graduates and for their families. I congratulate you on your accomplishment and wish you the very best. Thank you very much.
That was Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke addressing graduates of the University of South Carolina on Saturday. For a full transcript of Chairman Bernanke's remarks or to see a video of the speech, go to our website, onpointradio.org. We'll be bringing you more of these commencement addresses from across the country in the weeks to come. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.